This is the IBJ podcast for the week of June 17th, 2021, brought to you by Resultant, formerly KSM Consulting. I'm your host, Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. Now, I want to take you back to the controversy in February at Newfields, the nature and culture campus that serves as the home of the Indianapolis Museum of Art. The museum released an extensive job description for a new director, essentially its chief executive, in the process of emphasizing the need to diversify its patrons. The description also said that the new leader would need to maintain, quote, the museum's traditional core white audience. Criticism exploded on social media, and this became a national story in the arts community. The museum apologized for unintentionally being divisive rather than inclusive, but the damage was done. The episode quickly set into motion a reckoning for Newfields, driven in large part by its own staff. A group purporting to represent 85 staff members and stakeholders presented an open letter saying senior leadership continually subverted their efforts to create a more inclusive institution. They demanded that Charles Venable, the president of Newfields, resign, which he did. They demanded organizational changes and a deep reevaluation of the institution's board of trustees. A separate petition specifically asked that the board of trustees have a more diverse membership, that the museum overhaul its admission policy, and that staff and volunteers participate in anti-racist training. Now, let's fast forward to late May. The board of trustees elected Darianne Christian, a black woman, as the chair of the board. It also elected a slate of new board members that increased its percentage of members from diverse backgrounds from 8% to 25%. Darianne Christian now leads the effort to implement an extensive action plan to make Newfields a more empathetic, multicultural, and anti-racist institution. She, in fact, was instrumental in creating that action plan as a member of the Board of Trustees. While Christian is not well known outside of the philanthropic community, her background suggests that she is uniquely qualified for this assignment. She grew up in Gary, Indiana, in a family headed by a single mother who worked in the steel mills. She excelled in computer science, which was the degree she earned from DePaul University. She has an MBA from Notre Dame. She worked for a time with the CIA. She is a co-owner of BC Forward, a technology solutions and staffing firm that is the second largest minority-owned company in the Indianapolis area, founded by her husband, Justin Christian. And together, they envisioned and were the lead benefactors for DePaul's Justin and Darianne Christian Center for Diversity and Inclusion, which opened in 2017. She is known as a problem solver, and she's the guest for this week's podcast, discussing the vision for Newfields going forward and her journey from Gary to the leadership of one of the city's oldest and most important cultural institutions. Here's our conversation. It's my pleasure to welcome to the IBJ podcast, Darianne Christian, the new chair of the Newfields Board of Trustees. Thank you so much for making time today.
Thank you.
So in March of this year, after spending several weeks listening to staff and volunteers and members of the community and local artists, the Board of Trustees released a comprehensive action plan for diversity, equity, inclusion, and access. And it looks at every aspect of Newfields through these four lenses and seeks to promote those qualities. And this includes the admissions policy, the membership policies, employee training, the makeup of the leadership, all the exhibits and programming, and the relationship with the surrounding community. And I know you're really steeped in the transformation process, but I'd like you to look ahead about 2 or 3 years. From the point of view of a visitor, how will it be different?
Well, I think that in general, you know, Newfields, we had already started the process of trying to be a more diverse, equitable, and inclusive organization. But I think what you will see first and foremost will be that our intentions to be, as a museum, to be more inclusive will appear more deliberate. Historically, you know, museums, especially art museums, have typically catered to a very small audience. And so as a result, through our programming, through the faces you see, and through, you know, everything that we have going on here, you will just see, you know, a more intentional approach to everything from what we hang on our walls to the programming that we offer here at the museum when you come inside.
How about from the point of view of a staff member? How would working at Newfields be different?
I think from a staff perspective and what we've learned throughout our process is that as an organization, I feel like our communication channels weren't necessarily the best. And so one of the things that we as a board are focusing on is ensuring that throughout the organization, we do a better job of communicating with our staff from the very highest levels, which is the Board of Trustees, down to, you know, everyone throughout the organization. Because what we learned with the Change Newfields letter is that, you know, our staff didn't feel as if they had a voice to reach out to the Board of Trustees directly to express some concerns of things that they were seeing within the organization. And so our number one goal there as it relates to staff is ensuring that we give, you know, we provide them access to the board and that we do a better job of communicating what's going on within the organization across the organization overall. In addition, we'd like to diversify our staff from senior leadership on down to, you know, at every level in the organization, because we do realize that we have some work to do there as an organization. And we also want to be more intentional about our DEIA efforts, which we've already started with our DEIA consultant. We're putting together a project champion team. And in addition, our staff members are actually being trained on how to actually do the the IDI assessment for all new staff members and for everyone that comes, you know, into the organization. All of the board members now are required to attend, not only to do the DEIA training, but also to attend training at the Racial Equity Institute here in Indianapolis.
Now, in the press release about your election as the chair of the Board of Trustees, this is how you are described. She has been the driving force behind Newfields' work to transform itself into an empathetic, multicultural, and anti-racist institution. How so? Can you describe in more detail what your involvement was in creating the action plan?
After, you know, everything happened with Newfields, I was actually on vacation when everything happened. And I was on a vacation where I was completely, you know, it was an unplugged vacation. I was actually in the Exumas on the boat. And so I didn't have any cell phone service. Whoa. And it was very spotty. You know, if you've been in the Exumas, you understand that, you know, you really don't have. And so it was interesting. So as we were, you know, it was during COVID, the height of COVID. And so as a result, you know, as we were sailing back to Nassau, because we had to get COVID tests to come back home, my phone just started going off. So I got my laptop out because people were texting me and you know, I was just like kind of in shock or whatever, because, you know, people were asking me questions. And I was like, what is everybody talking about? Like, what is it? So then I just did a Google and I was like, oh, wow. You know, I was stunned because, you know, the Newfields I knew and, you know, just knowing the work that we were doing, it just seemed out of character, actually, for Newfields for something like that to have happened. And initially I was just
to the job posting.
Yes, the reaction to the job posting. So when I was able to be, you know, fully back in touch, immediately I was on a board call. Literally, I landed at 4 o'clock and there was a call at 4 o'clock. And, you know, on that call from like 4 to like maybe 8 o'clock that night, you know, discussing the situation. At the time, I was the only African American board member on the Board of Trustees. And so, of course, you know, and just throughout the process of our diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, I had given lots of feedback at board meetings. So, of course, everyone was looking to me saying, okay, well, Darian, what are your thoughts? You know, what do you think? And then, you know, at that time, I was just a board member on the committee. I wasn't involved in any leadership, like serious leadership capacity on the board. And so as this process was unfolding, you know, right in front of me, I just felt a need to get involved because I felt like, you know, Newfields was being represented, you know, in the media over this incident in a way that I knew internally that was not how we had been conducting ourselves. So I just stepped in and honestly, it was Katie Bentley, our board chair, Katie Bentley, who had the foresight. She said, Darian, we really need you to help us, you know, figure this out and figure out what we need to do moving forward. And I said, you know, anything I can do to be helpful, you know, I will. And then from that moment on, it just started the process of us really trying to figure out what we needed to do. And for me, with the committee, the first thing we decided was that, you know, we were just going to listen, that we were going to talk to the community to really understand the damage that had been done by Newfields as a result of this job posting. And, you know, and so Katie formed a commitment committee where we came together to figure out how to address, you know, this issue and how to make amends with the community and apologize for, you know, what had happened, and then right the ship going forward for the long term for Newfields.
Were you the leader of that committee?
Yes. Yes, I was the chairperson of that committee. That's correct.
Okay, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ podcast.
The right data and technology solution can transform your business. KSM Consulting is now Resultant and still passionate about solving problems no one else can. Still collaborating with our clients to find the best answer, not the easy answer. Visit Resultant.com to see what's possible for your organization.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ podcast. Again, our guest this week is Darianne Christian, the new chair of the Board of Trustees for Newfields. So you are just very deeply involved in helping craft the action plan as well. Is that right?
That's correct. That's correct.
Now, as the chair of the full Board of Trustees, for people who aren't familiar with how boards work, how do you as a board chair drive this kind of large scale institutional change?
The one I think what's interesting, and I think what everyone, what I want the world to understand about Newfields is that, you know, our trustees have, prior to, you know, the job posting, we were already in the process of, you know, our diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. And when you look at our strategic plan, there were certain things that when we wrote the commitment plan that were already, you know, things that we had in place that we knew we needed to do. We knew that, you know, we weren't engaging the community around us in the way that we wanted to. And so we had already evaluated that. One of my first assignments when I joined the committee, when I joined the board in 2016, as I was on the marketing committee. And we did a marketing study because we really wanted to understand, like, how can we draw more people at the time to the Indianapolis Museum of Art. And that marketing study was very telling. You know, it really highlighted for us what it means to be an art museum in the middle of the inner city here in Indianapolis. And so we had already started that process of, you know, figuring out what exactly is it that we need to do. And so even the name change to Newfields was a step for us in the direction of trying to be more inclusive. Because when you say art museum in a place like the Midwest, now this is not the case in places like in much larger markets like New York City, California, you know, maybe Chicago, but in a place like the Midwest, when you say art museum, it pretty much has a connotation of like just being a place reserved for people who are wealthy, well-educated, you know, white. And so as a result, we didn't want that to be how Newfields was defined. So that was why we actually changed the name to Newfields. We wanted it to be like a new way of life, a new way of thinking, a whole new attitude. And with that, the name change coincided with us implementing more programming that we felt would be more inclusive for the community, with things like winter lights, you know, fall harvest, all of the things, the additional programming that we've added in the past few years to help us to be more inclusive and try to draw a much broader, different audience from the traditional art museum audience. In addition, people, you know, were probably not aware of the fact that Newfields had started the process of deaccessioning artwork, because when we evaluated our collection, we realized that we relied on art by BIPOC persons. And so we had started the process, I believe it was maybe 3 years ago, possibly, you know, a little bit less, of deaccessioning art to raise money specifically to purchase additional art by BIPOC persons, because we knew that our galleries were not being frequented by the greater majority because the collection was so limited. And so I see my role as the board chair primarily as just someone to spearhead what we have in that commitment letter and what we committed to do. And that if, you know, by the time I, you know, finish up my term as board chair, if we have a broader, more diverse audience, and if we have a broader, more diverse art collection that draws in a broader audience, then we've set out to do what we wanted to do. And in addition, you know, ensuring that we're engaged in the community a little bit more than we have been. You know, we have Newfields, our campus, and a lot of our work has been centered here. We're working to decenter ourselves from that. One of the you know, things that we're working on right now is like, you know, for the, you know, the Juneteenth celebration, we're actually going to make it a point to go and volunteer in the community versus drawing people to Newfields. We're going out to help with, you know, the Juneteenth celebrations, staff, governors, trustees. We're putting ourselves out in the community more because our goal is to meet the community where they are at and to make this a place where everyone feels welcome and we can meet everyone with something that will appeal to them without the, you know, some of the negative connotations that come with, you know, what a traditional art museum has been.
So the museum already was working toward diversifying this collection. And I know in 2018 it hired Kelly Morgan as an associate curator, really with the responsibility of finding ways that the museum creates or reinforces narratives that downplay the Black experience or the experience of other ethnicities. And that she, I think, was told that she would have the freedom to make the collection and exhibits more inclusive. And then last July, of course, she resigned and saying that the museum's environment, I think, was toxic and that it failed to support artwork done by minorities. How did the board take that news?
Well, that's a personnel issue. So I'm not really allowed to go into detail or discuss that, but I can assure you that we all felt a sincere loss with the loss of Dr. Morgan here at Newfields. But it certainly did not change our course to continue to still work towards our diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. We see that situation as same, you know, in the same way that we do the, you know, job description. What I like to point out, and, you know, my husband and I, we have, you know, we are committed to the diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts, you know, in every facet of everything that we're involved in. And one of the conversations that we always have is that, you know, the organizations that are doing the work are the ones that are getting in trouble, right? Because if you're mixing up your staff, you know, I sit on boards and I have to have these conversations where I say to the board, you know, everyone's saying, hey, well, we want to do DEIA. I said, well, are you ready? Right? Because a lot of organizations, they aren't ready. You know, you may have a longstanding employee who's a great employee, who's been with the organization 25 years. And you're saying, okay, now you want to diversify your staff. But if you give that employee an intercultural development assessment, and it shows that, you know, they may not be prepared to manage minorities, right? You're going to have some behaviors that then will come across as microaggressions, right? For that minority who's now working for a non-minority who's never really managed a minority before. And they're a good employee, right? The person who's been with the company, but they just don't have that frame of reference or that experience with working with minorities. And so then, you know, you may end up with a situation where that employee may have a claim of, you know, discrimination and a very valid and legitimate claim. But at the same token, the organization overall was trying to do the right thing, which was, hey, let's diversify our workforce. But there's a method to how you do this, right? You know, so when you say, you know, you're going to undertake a DEIA effort, you know, that's just one example of how, you know, an organization can find themselves on the wrong side of their DEIA efforts when they were actually trying to do the right thing.
Did you think that the job posting was evidence of a discriminatory mindset among the museum leadership, or was that just something that was poorly stated?
It was something that was poorly stated. I would not say that that was the mindset of this organization, because from my perspective, where I sat, now I can't speak to what our staff may have felt or what they were dealing with. Because as a trustee, I'm in for 5 meetings a year and a couple committee meetings. But what I do know is that in our trustee meetings, diversity was always at the forefront of our conversations. We here at Newfields, there was an evaluation that was done by the leadership that said our lowest paid staff workers made $12 an hour. And the decision was made that a livable wage in Indiana is $18 an hour. And so we're going to change that. We're going to up, you know, our employees' core wages till they get to what's considered a livable wage. Those were the types of conversations that we were having in the board meeting. The conversation was had about, you know, time off from work. You know, if you're a low wage worker, maybe a single parent, and you know, you need to take time off, you know, and you only have 2 weeks vacation. The burden is greater on a person that may not necessarily have the support, who's not wealthy, and to use their vacation to take off if they have a sick kid or an issue. And so we went to unlimited time off for our staff to level the playing ground across the board. So these were things that we were doing inside of Newfields that, you know, a lot of people may not have been aware of, which are very radical changes from a diversity, equity, and inclusion perspective, right? To make the decision that you're going to, you know, up everyone's wages to a livable wage. But that's not to say that there weren't things that we weren't getting right, because otherwise I wouldn't be here having this conversation with you. And we've acknowledged that, and we know what they are. And we know that as we're going through this process, the first conversation I had with the commitment committee when we started was, I said, you know, okay, guys, we have this job posted. I said, but I want you to understand that there's other landmines out there. There's other things that are going to happen that we're going to uncover, you know, and I want the world to know that, because I don't want us to be cut off, you know, as a result, because we're making the choice to go look for them and root them out and find them and deal with them, you know, and I don't think it's fair to us that we have to operate in fear of, you know, people deciding they're just going to cut Newfields off because we're making the choice. And, you know, I'm very transparent. So when, you know, things come up, issues come up, I immediately am totally open to speaking with the staff, you know, immediately open to speaking with the trustees, even against the advice of, you know, maybe, you know, legal counsel or whatever. But from my mind, you know, racism thrives in the darkness, right? When people don't speak up, when they don't call it for what it is. And that's not who I am. And that's not what I'm going to do. And I think, you know, and, you know, the rest of the board, they, you know, they understand that about me, they support me. And, you know, I feel like we're in a really good place from a, you know, from the board's perspective and from a leadership perspective right now to really move this institution forward.
This might fall under the rubric of personnel decisions, but can you say whether or not the board asked Charles Venable to resign?
No, I cannot. That's a personnel issue.
Do you think that he needed to resign in order to move forward?
I think I'll choose to pass on that question.
Fair enough. I want to acquaint our listeners with your background because it's really fascinating. And I'm going to start us off with a few things that I think but you certainly can correct me if I'm wrong. You were born and raised in Gary, Indiana. You received your BA in computer science from DePaul University and an MBA in management from the University of Notre Dame.
That's correct.
So far, so good. While you were studying computer science at DePaul, how many of your classmates also were Black women?
None. I think I may be the first African-American computer science graduate of DePaul, African-American female computer science graduate of DePaul. There was, I think my senior year, there was a young lady that then started studying computer science. I don't know if she stuck with it and graduated with it or not.
What was your interest in computer science?
So it's interesting. So I grew up in Gary and, you know, a single parent mom. You know, my mom had 5 children. There were 4. I had a sister that passed away at a very young age. But, you know, so there were all these programs, you know, back when the government got the importance of having programs for poor kids. And so I went to like a computer camp one summer and learned how to program. And back then it was just like you wrote a program to like move a ball across the screen. Right. So that was, you know, and that was in, I believe that was in middle school. And then there really weren't any other opportunities for me to do anything else with it. You know, we didn't have computers, right, back then. And even when I was in college, you know, when you went your program, the computer science building was the one building that stayed open 24 hours, right? Because we had to go to the computer lab to write our programs. And then when it was time for me to go to college, I decided pretty early on that I wanted to go to DePaul. I had visited DePaul as a sophomore, and they had a guy who recruited me very heavily to come to DePaul. And when I was trying to decide what I wanted to major in, you know, I did early admission, early decision, and I had decided I was going to study computer science. And part of the reason I chose computer science was because I had always worked during high school, you know, minimum wage. You know, my first job was McDonald's. Then I did like telemarketing. Then I, you know, sold insurance. Of course, I was recruited, you know, by the Central Intelligence Agency my senior year of high school. And I had pretty much decided at that time I was going to study computer science because it was a well-paying job. And I just, you know, I grew up struggling. Like, I understood what it meant to have bills that you couldn't pay. You know, I watched my mother struggle. You know, we spent a lot of time alone. My mother worked in a steel mill in Gary. You know, there'd be times where she would go in and work the 7-to-3 shift, and then she'd call us and say, hey, I'm gonna work second shift. I can get overtime, you know, and then she, you know, be from the phone directing, you know, my sister and I, put the roast in the oven, cut up the potatoes, you know, make sure you clean up, you know, did you do your homework? I just knew I didn't want to have to struggle like that. I didn't want to have to work two shifts and then, you know, and computer science at the time was a well-paying job. And I had enjoyed computer programming. It came, you know, pretty easy for me. And, you know, it just worked itself out. And then I believe that's how the agency decided to find me, because at the time they were struggling to recruit. They couldn't compete with the private sector in the early 90s. For hiring computer science professionals, because at that time our salaries were extremely high and the federal government couldn't pay at the same rate that, you know, the private sector could.
Can you tell us anything about what you did, even just in general, what your responsibilities were for the CIA?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I was in a program, you know, they would train me in different areas and they really never told you what their plans were for you. You just kind of got upped to whatever it is, whatever it was that they wanted you to do. You know, you just had different job assignments. So you may, you know, when I would, you know, at one point I may have been like in the, you know, the foreign programs group. And then, you know, in another point I may have been, you know, in the security group where they do, you know, polygraphs and things like that. At another point I may have been in the, like a COTR, which is a, you know, a contracting officer's technical representative, where you go and all of these people that are contractors for the, you know, federal government building all of these, you know, crazy things. It's like, I really never understood what their intent was for me. But I knew that, you know, I had worked there. And after the situation with Mira Malkanzi, where he walked up where my coworkers were waiting at the turn signal to turn in to work. And he just walked up between the two turning lanes and just started shooting into people's cars. I had made my decision at that point that it probably wasn't a place for me long term.
And then from there, you had a career working in information technology as a program manager and a consultant at various companies. And my understanding is that you became mm-hmm. known as a fix-it mm-hmm. guru. I mean, somebody who was very good at solving organizational problems. Why are you good at
that? Yes, that's kind of like, I think growing up poor makes you very resourceful. And in addition, like I said, you know, we spent a lot of time alone as children because my mom had to work. And my mom was a hard worker. And so I think like my mom and all of my, you know, aunts and uncles, my mom had 11 brothers and sisters. And my uncle, who I was closest to, who, you know, he was a military man. Then he worked for the Department of Navy. And so when I lived in D.C., I was very close with him. I think just having a family that has like a very strong work ethic, like everybody in my family gets up at like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. You know, they've already, you know, done so many things by the time before most people have woke up, have even gotten up for the day. And I think just having a strong work ethic, I think that, you know, my social economics have changed. I tell people what I think makes me unique is that, you know, I've been in every social economic class from the very bottom to the top 1%. And so it gives me perspective. So my husband always jokes that he's like, I can take my wife to the neighbor, because I grew up on 3rd and Van Buren in Gary, right? There was a crack house next door to the house that I grew up in. You know, people were dealing drugs. And my husband always jokes that he says, I can take my wife to, you know, the neighborhood in the inner city, or I can take her to the White House and she can handle herself. And so I just think the fact that, you know, I have you know, experienced like so many things throughout my life, been in all social economics class. I've lived in the poorest of neighborhoods. I've lived in really wealthy neighborhoods. You know, I've had nothing. I've had a lot. And I just choose to see people, you know, for who they are. You know, I appreciate some of the lessons that I learned as a child. My mother was very realistic with us. She never really sugarcoated anything. I always tell people she wasn't big on, you know, like self-esteem. You know, she would always say to us, you know, everybody puts their pants on one leg at a time, just like you. And everybody's going to stand before God on judgment day, just like you, you know. So I think just my, you know, that's always just shaped my perspective. And so I've always had to try to have to figure things out for myself from a very young age, you know, because my mom had to work. I had to do my homework on my own. She couldn't afford a tutor. I had to figure, you know, things out. And I think that's just always stuck with me. You know, my husband, you know, he refers to me, you know, in his business because he started the business shortly after we were married. And he always refers to me as the pinch hitter for BC Forward. Like whenever they're in a pinch, he can call me to help him out. Like he comes home with all of this stuff and he's like, D, you help me figure out what to do here. And so, and I do enjoy problem solving. That's all, it's just something that's come naturally to me.
And do you feel like your experiences in business and in DePauw and with the center, they informing the work that you're doing now with the museum?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I feel like it gives me a perspective that a lot of minorities still aren't able to have, right? My husband and I, as business owners, we own not only one of the largest probably the largest African-American business in the state, but it's also one of the largest business in the state. And so as a result, that gives us, you know, access and the ability to be in rooms that maybe other African-Americans might not have the opportunity to be in. Right. And so with that comes the ability to glean certain things and then take them back and say, OK, well, this, you know, works or this doesn't work. And, you know, and just being able to give the perspective, you know, when we're talking about something, you know, I'm also on the board of CICF and, you know, the Eskenazi Howe Foundation. And so there's certain things that like maybe when conversations are coming up, OK, well, I can give you what a poor person's perspective is because I've been poor and I get it. You know, I understand that like, hey, you know, that ticket price is too high or, you know, well, they don't have a way to get here. Things that sometimes people who have everything may not even consider as a barrier.
Well, this is great. Why don't we check back in about a year and see how things are going?
That sounds like a plan.
My thanks again to Darianne Christian. Hey, before you get on with the rest of your week, I want to draw your attention to some strong stories in the latest print edition of IBJ. First up, you can add Indianapolis-based Herf Jones to the long list of local companies that have been hacked for their customers' personal information. Susan Orr reports the company now faces three lawsuits from college students and their parents who say they were hit with fraudulent credit and debit card charges after using those cards to order caps, gowns, and other graduation gear from the Herf Jones website. Also in this issue, John Russell reports that use of the two COVID-19 antibodies developed by Eli Lilly and Company has been waning in the U.S. And Kirk Christian reveals that Carmel, Fishers, and Noblesville are among the roughly 50 cities nationwide that are now projected to get less than half of the COVID relief money they originally expected. Again, you can read these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at IBJ.com. I will say it is quite a bit easier to access all of the latest local news about business and politics and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business community and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to IBJ.com and click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.